Okay, if we could start. My name is Mark Simon. I'm with a firm called Torreya Partners. This is my 31st year advising biotech companies, so I began when I was 12 years old. Anyway, pleasure to be here. It's my hair loss. If we could go back 15 years, I like looking at the history, see where we've come. If this panel were happening 15 years ago about how to accelerate drug discovery, novel ways to fund cancer research, et cetera, the word venture philanthropy did not exist. So that whole ecosystem of the foundations and everything that we've seen really non-existent. In fact, if you look at the history of foundations, you look at the CF Foundation and Mike Milken's Prostate Cancer Foundation, but just to give some history about how they got started, because I think it's emblematic of how much things have changed. When Michael Milken was diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer over 20 years ago, he went to all the big pharmas and said, why do you have no cancer pipelines? Why are you allocating no research money to oncology? And they all said to him, because it's a tiny market. Even Amgen, there's actually a TV interview on this, he met with Gordon Binder, who was the CEO. Amgen was making $1 billion a year on Neupogen, so they were making $1 billion treating the side effects of chemotherapy. And Mike said, why are you not focused on cancer drugs to actually shrink tumors versus treat the side effects? Amgen said it was a tiny market. So we all know, you know, what's happened since then. The other thing that's also happened in the 15 years as an observer is the importance of patients and the fact that we really are becoming a patient-centric era, or the patients are really at the center of this ecosystem. And again, just to give an example of Mike Milken, when he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and so was Norman Schwarzkopf, they called up Larry King, and they wanted to go on Larry King because they thought that was the best way to encourage men to get their PSAs checked. In the case of Mike Milken, his PSA was checked too late. And he was very much motivated by somebody called Steve Ross, who was the CEO of now currently Time Warner, who had back pain for 1 year, and they finally checked his PSA, and it was 100, and he died a relatively gruesome death. So that's what motivated when Mike Milken decided to have a PSA test. It was the fact that his friend did not. So they went to Larry King, and they said, could we be on your show to encourage every man over 50 to get their PSA test? And Larry King said, NFW, no way, nobody will watch it. It's a terrible idea. So Mike Milken, being resourceful, since he had financed Ted Turner, who owned the network, he cashed in a chit. He called Ted Turner, and Ted Turner relented. And Norman Schwarzkopf and Mike Milken were on Larry King's show, and it was the most watched show that year. And then he had Bob Dole come in and other people, and that was really kind of the beginning of moving the patients into the center of the ecosystem. Also, 15 years ago, if you look at Big Pharma, a lot of their research was very centralized, very top-down. When I was at Roberts and Stevens and we had our biotech healthcare conference, I remember people from Pfizer and Sanofi and Aventis, they had a badge that said Pfizer Central Research, Aventis Central Research. You know, GE, for example, had this central research campus, AT&T. And I think you have to say that the world has really changed from the era of central research. Also back then, the venture capitalists were really the major financial experts or the financial sources of capital for early stage companies. So let's fast forward to today, 15 years later. How are we accelerating drug discovery? How has the ecosystem changed? And each of these panelists represents a component of that new emerging ecosystem. Well, first of all, and again, Celgene and Lilly are great examples, R&D has become very fluid. It's become very external. It's become very networked. It's connected to multiple stakeholders. They interact with academia, other biotech companies, patient groups, VCs, NIH, academia. The whole network is now connected. 15 years ago, it was all siloized, and that made things very inefficient. It can still improve, but it's now a much more connected universe. Also, again, since with Mike Milken's success in prostate cancer and the CF Foundation and the wealth creation in the last 15 years in the U.S., many billionaires or wealthy people who end up getting a disease where there's not a lot of therapeutic alternatives, they start a foundation. So we've had an explosion of disease foundations. And these foundations really only care about one thing, and that's accelerating drugs for their patients. They really have no bias. They really have a very pure objective. About 2 years ago, I introduced Mrs. Hamburg on a panel, and when the panel was over, she asked me, who should I listen to? She said, as FDA commissioner, I hear from congressmen, senators, prime ministers, the White House, HHS, patient advocates, biotech companies, governors, you name it. Think about it. If you're FDA commissioner, how many requests come into you a day? So she asked me, when I get the calls, who has the right agenda? Who doesn't have a biased agenda? And I took her through, for example, bio is a very effective group for the biotech companies, but for the most part, the larger biotech companies have the predominant say. In pharma, again, the people who run it, they also can have a predominant say. Everybody has their bias, but I said to her, the disease foundations and the patient advocacy groups are really the ones that have the best agenda. They're not really investors in the stock market. They really are pure objective of getting new drugs for their patients and for their advocates. So in terms of this panel, I'm going to let each of the panelists give their background, but the whole paradigm has changed, and I want each of the panelists not only to give their background, but talk about how their organization, whether it's from Rockefeller, whether it's from Lilly, leukemia lymphoma, whether it's from MRA, the Disease Foundation side, talk about how their organization is impacting in this new drug discovery paradigm. And again, the major goal is to advance cancer research. So why don't we start with the disease advocates? And I will let Lewis start. And also, I think you have slides, so that will also give you the prerogative.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I think I want to hitchhike on some of Mark's comments, really, about the disease organizations. Just a little bit of background. So I spent a dozen years in academic science. My area of focus was the development of the brain. I suspect my academic colleagues might suggest that I defected to the dark side after that and went to work for Wyeth Pharmaceuticals and spent another 15 years in biotech and pharma before joining the LLS. I'm the president and CEO there now. I am going to beg the indulgence of my fellow panelists and show you two slides that I think can better illustrate 2 points that I want to make and try to break a stereotype, a couple of stereotypes that you might have about patient organizations. So this slide represents the cumulative research funding deployed by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society since the 1970s. And since you probably can't read it from the back, I'll tell you that last year we passed a major milestone, and that is we've invested $1 billion, actually over $1 billion, in funding research and the development of new therapies for the hematological malignancies since the 1970s. So the stereotype I'd like to break here is that organizations like LLS are just bit players when it comes to funding research. It's far from the truth. We deploy over $80 million a year into research, both in supporting programs in academia and in supporting partnerships with the biotechnology and pharmaceutical industry. So I hope you can appreciate the impact that this kind of funding has, in fact, made in the blood cancers. We've touched the discovery of virtually every therapy that's currently used to treat the blood cancers. This is the second image I wanted to show you, and the stereotype I'd like to break down for you is that organizations like LLS are, quote-unquote, just patient advocates. We're far more than that. We really are in a position to bring together all of the players in the ecosystem of creating new therapies for the blood cancers. We partner with academia through our grant programs. We partner with biotech and pharma through our version of venture philanthropy called the Therapy Acceleration Program. I can do something at LLS that I couldn't do when I was in the pharmaceutical industry, and that is if I convene a meeting and invite the FDA, they actually come. And so we're in front of the FDA on a regular basis. Clearly we can't influence them, but we can educate them. We can describe the state of the art of the science and the medicine. We represent the voice of the patient. We represent the patient unmet medical need in front of the FDA. We're currently regularly in front of third-party payers, both government and private sector. To be honest with you, our message there is that there's value in innovation. My goal is to make certain that patients have access to quality, affordable, life-saving care. And being able to be in front of both the FDA and in front of the third-party payers is a key part of that. And I'll end just by reinforcing something that Mark said, and that is we are a trusted voice with patients and with providers, and we convey information to them on a regular basis. On the patient side, for example, we run a clinical trial matching service out of our office and have multiple routes of really continuing to bring together all of the players in this ecosystem to get to where we want to get, and that is cures for the blood cancers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. I'll stop.
Louise?
Good afternoon. I'm Louise Perkins. I'm the Chief Science Officer at the Melanoma Research Alliance. I don't have any slides, but I will definitely build off of the comments that both Mark and Lou have made. Lou did a really nice job of describing some of the general places, or describing more generally, the places in which advocacy groups can play a role in the current environment. Let me tell you just a little bit about our organization, the Melanoma Research Alliance, and the things we do. And then I think what we will naturally evolve into is a conversation about where does that take us from here, because it's my contention and our contention that patient advocacy groups and research nonprofits specifically can play a fantastic role in catalyzing things going forward. The Melanoma Research Alliance was founded in 2007 by Deborah Black, shortly after, and her husband Leon Black, under the auspices of the Milken Institute. This was shortly after Deborah's diagnosis with a subtype of melanoma known as acromelanoma. And after her care came together and she's done very well, she went to her good friend Michael Milken and said, I want to do in melanoma what you've done in prostate cancer. The prognosis is really quite dire, and there really hadn't been that much improvement at that time in 2007. With that in mind, MRA was born with our mission to eliminate suffering and death due to melanoma. So as I said, that was 2007. Now, fast forward to now, we have in those years been able to invest in research $60 million. We aspire to $1 billion, but $60 million is a significant investment in a relatively small period of time. And given the background of our founders in the financial business, we are keen to leverage other people's money, to bring other people's money to the problem of melanoma, and are proud to have been able to document that we've been able to leverage an additional $66 million on melanoma, either through partnered funding or follow-on funding that comes in and has been applied to the problem. The organization is based in Washington, D.C. We are small but mighty. There are 9 of us on staff. My own background is that I started out in the pharmaceutical business and was in pharma doing target identification and new drug discovery. Did that for 16 years, first at Schering Plow and then at Bayer Pharmaceuticals, and then transitioned into the nonprofit world and was the CSO at the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation before coming over to MRA. I think when, just to give you a little bit of an overview about the kinds of things that we fund, we really are aiming at catalyzing the research enterprise in the melanoma space. So we are helping to create the next generation of investigators with a focus on early career investigators. They're near and dear to us, and we aim to fund more than 10 of those annually. We also fund established investigators. Neil Rosen, David Sollett are some of those established investigators who we funded. We have a strong emphasis on team science. These are $1 million awards, multi-year awards, that bring together people with particular expertise to focus on a problem and have been very successful for us. And as I said, we do all of that by being very efficient with our use of resources and catalyzing other people's funds to come together to melanoma. One way we do that is by a collaborative funding model that we've established, which has several forms. And in one instance, it involves collaborative funding with the academic institutions, in which we would provide either one-third or a half, depending on the type of award, and the institution provides two-thirds of the overall grant. Development offices, believe it or not, actually appreciate this model because it comes from an organization like us with a world-class grant review behind it, and then development officers can go out and close the deal on some asks that they may have out. Likewise, we co-fund with industry, but we do fund academic research only. Our model of venture philanthropy is not to fund companies. We fund academic researchers, but we have several examples in which we've been able to jointly fund with pharma or biotech companies those academic research programs. And likewise, we jointly fund with other nonprofits. You heard earlier Pat LaRusso speak about the Stand Up to Cancer MRA Melanoma Dream Team. That is one such example of a co-funding opportunity about which we're very excited. And we have done others, even across diseases, with longevity and the Lung Cancer Research Foundation as an example. So I'll just wrap up. The other aspect of our organization is that we take the alliance part of our name very seriously and are keen to work in various alliances with a number of folks, including the government leaders, the FDA, not only to provide them with education about the latest and greatest in the field, as Lou touched on, but also to engage them in problem solving. They have a tremendous amount of wisdom and insight to offer, and I really applaud this oncology group at the FDA for their willingness to bring science to the problem in the context of the FDA. It's just been fantastic, and they don't get enough credit for it. Likewise, we host an annual scientific retreat, which brings 250 individuals together across academia, industry, government, from around the world, to catalyze new discussions, new projects, and to really focus on identifying what are the opportunities that will need to be addressed in the future. We anticipate through our scientific strategy that's designed not only with academic input but with industry input, what will the needs be in the field moving forward, and that is a very important place that nonprofits can play a role.
Thank you. Nathan, your background, and also where does Lilly fit in this new business model, the new paradigm of how R&D is done that's more connected, more networked, more fluid, et cetera?
Sure. Good afternoon. I'm Nathan Sandburn. So I work within Lilly in the oncology business, and my role's in strategy and business development. My background, I've been a molecular biologist by training and have kind of navigated what is, I think, as Lou put it, the dark side at some level. But I worked at the Indiana University Medical School when the NIH was funding the vector labs, and I actually helped build one of the vector labs in Indiana, which was the Murine Maloney leukemia vector-based lab. And what we were doing was generating viruses for human use. So at that time, we were putting multiple drug resistance gene and MGMT and ADA into vectors for transfer into humans, and we were actually doing that at GMP scale. And that was a very exciting time. We were able to see what was, you know, in many views, the emergence of what is now the CAR-T-based approaches, a lot of the same methodologies used back then, you know, that was just called gene therapy, right? And at this point, there's a lot of excitement in that space, and I think the biology goes to support it. What I did after that was I moved into Lilly and have joined into the clinical development arena, and then moved into the search and evaluation side of the business in oncology specifically, where for about 6 years I did the search and evaluation of external assets, partnering, licensing, acquisition, as well as funding and evaluations of those opportunities. And then just a couple of years ago, I moved into the oncology business unit in working through all of the transactions that we would do in this space. But that's my background. So at Lilly, we're led by Dr. Greg Plowman on our LRL side, our research side, and then Dr. Richard Gaynor, whom you probably have seen yesterday sitting on the panel with regard to combinations. But the group is led by a couple of very good folks. And what we've done in the past here as we think about funding and conducting research, what Lilly's done some of the traditional funding. You know, we have a Lilly Ventures arm that looks at very early funding, seed funding, some Series A funding, even Series B as well. And they've been actually very successful. That's led by Ed Torres. And that's one of the traditional corporate venture arms of our organization in putting money into research. And then we do, you know, a number of the traditional licensing, partnering, and collaborations. Okay, so collaborations can take on it in different forms, and I'll kind of come back to that in a second. But as we look at conducting and funding the research, we know that it boils down to basically three parts, right? You have the idea, you have the people that can do it, and then you have the money that can actually fund it. So those three things are what you're going to need in any given idea and moving it forward. And I think at Lilly, what we've taken on is this concept that we don't necessarily have to own all three, and we've used some innovative ways in order to approach that. So one of those examples is we generate some capital funds, some limited partner funds, whereby Lilly was one of the partners to put money into that, and then we also have a unit within our organization called the Chorus Group, which are the people. It's an efficient way to get clinical trials done using the funds from this particular limited partner fund. And then we solicited externally as well as internally, but most of the ideas came from the external. What are the ideas that could go into this model? And led by Darren Carroll, who's our head of corporate development, he really championed this as an effort, and we've done a couple of partnerships, limited partnership funds, and it's going very well as far as development of molecules. But Chorus is a very efficient way to get those done with the people. The funding comes from the partnership, and it's gone well over the last few years. I also would highlight we recently invested in the New York group here together with Celgene as well, and this is one that we're excited about as Dr. Plowman sits just down on 29th and 1st and the research group down there. Very excited about working with folks here in New York as well as continuing to explore other ways that we can look at these type of public partnerships that would allow for research to get brought out of the certain geographies. So that particular one is $100 million is looked to be deployed to bring 15 to 20 new ventures before 2020. So this is another model as we think about innovative ways to get money into research. Outside of just your traditional licensing, partnering, acquisition that is helpful to really move forward. And for Lilly, as in general, our goal is to increase access to that research that, hopefully comes with preferential access at some level. But the goal is to get the real science done, be able to get the money into the places where that science is getting done, and hopefully Lilly would have the ability to access that as the results are seen. So in summary, I guess, we're trying to balance, output of capital, output of finances with the resources that we have internally, et cetera, et cetera. And we're all doing that in this industry at this point in time. I'll stop with this. One of the examples here is we recognize that research and good ideas don't have to come from within our walls, and we'll use Alimta as an example. Many of you know, I've heard of Pemetrexed and Alimta. This came from Princeton. This was a collaboration that was taken on and eventually, brought into Lilly, and a lot of the heavy lifting done within our walls, the idea didn't come from within our walls, but the collaboration between us, Princeton, moving toward elucidating squamous versus non-squamous, et cetera, was really a great example of how we see both an academic and collaboration partnerships to be the way that you can really get good medicines brought to patients and be able to have them benefit from the research that goes on in that space.
Thank you. Kathleen, your perch from academia?
My perch from academia. It's interesting that you say 15 years was your time frame. I'm a trained immunologist. I was at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute at UCLA for 6 years, following my postdoc there, and then transitioned to a diagnostics company in Santa Monica. When I moved back to the East Coast, I began my career in academic industry relations by going back to work at the University of Pennsylvania, where I had gotten my PhD, but in their Center for Technology Transfer. So I left the science of science and began with the business of science, which I have to say I like a great deal. But 15 years ago, I came to New York, brought here by Rockefeller to establish their first office of technology transfer. And it was a very, very different time in New York. I think you said the word silos. Not only were companies siloed, the universities were terribly siloed. We didn't really talk to one another. I think there was a lot of competition. There wasn't a lot of collaboration. My colleagues and I, a number of us, the offices had just changed hands at the time. Three of us came from the Philadelphia area to move up here. Abram Goldfinger, who's still my colleague at NYU, Michael Clear, who had taken over the office at Columbia University, and I, along with Pat McGrath at Mount Sinai, started something called the New York Academic Consortium with the seven largest academic institutions here in New York to show people, because it was embarrassing to us to go to conferences and hear that the universities in New York were totally unproductive and they couldn't get along. So 15 years ago, we started pushing water uphill, and now it's really taken off. And I'm not saying we're responsible for it, but we were at the right time at the right place. And back then, the only time I saw large companies is perhaps if a faculty member of mine showed me a consulting agreement. We used to call that limousine science. A black car used to come from Connecticut or from New Jersey. They would pick up our faculty member in the morning, drive them out for a day at their facility, give them a nice lunch, maybe a check, drive them back. That was our interaction with large pharma 15 years ago. It is so different now. It's startling. We have true collaborations with large pharma. We, of course, have maintained collaborations with small companies, with startup companies, with mid-sized companies. But the real sea change has been with large pharma. Lots of new leadership at the institutions here in New York, which has led to a lot of interest in New York science, a lot of highlighting of New York science. Pfizer was one of the brave who first came here and established their Centers for Therapeutic Innovation about 5 years ago. We collaborate with them. The Seattle Accelerator came about 3 years ago and finally raised their money and are off and running down at the Alexandria Center. Just the whole vision of the Alexandria Center was something that none of us would have dreamed 15 years ago with the presence there of Lilly and Pfizer and Roche and many small companies. It's just fantastic. The end of this month, on Monday, March 30th, there'll be an announcement, which hopefully some of my colleagues will be there, of the New York City Venture Fund. And we have been really excited about that for quite a while. With our colleagues, Memorial Sloan Kettering and Weill Cornell Medical School, we've begun the Tri-Institutional Therapeutics Discovery Initiative. The three institutions have banded together, formed a separate 501c3. Our first partner in this was announced over a year ago. It's Takeda Pharmaceuticals. We now have 16 Takeda medicinal chemists in a laboratory on East 69th Street working on eight different projects from our institutions. Most of our people didn't know how to spell medicinal chemistry 15 years ago. Also, unique to Rockefeller alone is a type of venture philanthropy. Julian Robertson, the financier, gave Rockefeller last year $25 million to spend $5 million a year for translational research. So this helps us with those projects that we show small companies, mid-sized companies, and our large company friends, and they say, you know, if you did this experiment or this experiment or maybe this mouse model, we now can fund those experiments. We take your advice and we fund the experiments internally. We can employ outside consultants. We can employ outside CROs to do these things. So that has been a really exciting change in the last 2 years. It has been a fabulous 15 years here in New York, and I hope I speak for all of my academic colleagues saying that the convergence that we have all seen has been really spectacular, and we hope it continues.
Thank you. Tom, love to hear your perspective. Of course, if you look at Celgene versus the rest of the biopharmaceutical industry, it's probably the paragon of creativity, unique structures. My son goes to school with a friend of his whose father works at Celgene, and I was talking to my son once over dinner, and my son asked me, well, how many deals has Celgene done? And next to me was a Heinz ketchup bottle. I said 57 by default. And that may be a number that may be pretty close in terms of what you guys have done in terms of an open research model.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here and on this panel with these colleagues and to be able to speak to you. My background is quite diverse. I have been leading research and early development at Celgene for the last 9 years. But prior to that, I am actually a lapsed nephrologist who played a dominant role in building the cancer center at Vanderbilt with Harold Moses and many others, Larry Marnette. I think one of the perspectives that has driven our behavior at Celgene has been some of the diversity of experience that happened after I left academics. I was a senior executive in research at Immunex. We were acquired by Amgen. And then subsequent to my departure from Amgen, we built a small company called Ambrx based in San Diego. So I can honestly say that I've sort of had experiences both positive and negative from each of those sort of life events. Academics, where I played a role in helping transform the Vanderbilt Tech Transfer Office, and all the way through each of the progressions that I described. So that's probably enough about me. I'm very pleased to tell you a little bit about how the distributed model at Celgene has sort of evolved and some of the perspectives that led to that evolution. I think Mark set it up quite well. This is really an ecosystem, and as Lou's slide illustrated, each of the component puzzle pieces needs really to touch all of the others. I noticed that he put his right in the center, but you know, I might suggest that each of the pieces needs to have interactive interfaces with each of the others. And in fact, the history of success at Celgene really kind of poised us unusually for appreciating how dynamic and valuable the external community could be. As many of you know, thalidomide was initially approved not as a myeloma treatment, but instead as an anti-inflammatory for patients with leprosy. And Celgene depended very, very prominently on the external community to illustrate that it had value in myeloma and then to help with the subsequent evolution of lenalidomide, pomalidomide, and other pipeline assets. So we, in fact, from inception, had deep appreciation for networking and understanding what the community outside could offer. We also have a bit of a contrarian willingness to consider all things, not just in terms of thalidomide making an important drug, but also in the possibility that innovation from regulators, innovation from academics, innovation from each of those puzzle pieces in the ecosystem is still valuable. And so we've endeavored to have a very open mind and to build business models that were very thoughtfully aligned between our interests and those of the other parties that we were engaging. And Lou can speak a bit more about it, but at this point it might just be worth highlighting that we created a fund that supported one of Lou's key missions at LLS that we named Quest for Cures, which was in fact very much a collaborative effort, really anchored in the belief that some of the questions that needed to be answered in the academic community at the interface with drug development and oncology were not really being asked in the way that we thought might be valuable. So rather than trying to go through a standard NIH or NCI process, by simply using the incredibly well-oiled capability that Lou and his colleagues have built at LLS, we were able to actually, about 3.5 years ago, ask questions that have been instrumentally highlighted at this conference. Clonality, the role that clonality plays in both resistance, how to phenotype cells from genomic and epigenomic angles, what are the stratification features in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and how does the microenvironment play in cancer? So those were three topical elements that we used in conjunction with LS to drive what I think has been not only in concept but in reality innovative science. And Lou can cite some of the exciting work that has come out of that funding mechanism. So that's a way that we catalyzed in a purposeful manner interactions with LLS and patient advocacy groups, but also to engage the academic community. The other networking attitude that we have had is that the opportunity to play early with emergent, potentially transformative companies has been sort of an anchoring concept for our strategy. Now, in each of the cases that where we have built collaborative networks, we've had discussions with J.P. Bisseri, who is over in the corner and will chair the next panel, or my colleague who was so instrumental in all of our approvals over the last 4 years. But we also had strategic connection to our internal scientific leadership, recognizing where we thought there would be emergent, transformative either technologies or drug candidate development opportunities. We really made pretty deep investments there, and some of them reflected in successes like the Agios IDH1 story. Trevor is here from Sutro, where we've made a bet in biologics. And there are a number of other of these plays that have been very much anchored in strategic intent tied back to our belief system about what would emerge as transformative. So, and then finally, all of this has sort of been knit together by a willingness to be, as Mark set up, a non-centralized, non-dominant, megalithic research organization. So, in fact, we have research efforts distributed in San Diego, San Francisco, Seattle, Bedford, Massachusetts, and Seville, Spain, in addition to our corporate headquarters in Summit, New Jersey. That has given us a chance to tap local talent, connectivity to academic investigators, and frankly to venture capitalists who understand what is emerging in each of those markets and given us a, sort of an anchored position to play forward. So anyway, those are a number of the key elements. We are, I'm delighted to say, Raj Chopra has been instrumental in building this with us. George Golombeski, our business development leader, has been truly creative in finding win-win situations with small companies. And Rob Hirschberg has just joined us to lead the Seattle effort. So we have a very dynamic and engaged group of people that are trying to keep this network well poised to contribute at a high level. So I'll stop there.
Great. Yeah, I want to give one example about Celgene, and it gets to culture. And I think if you go back to the history of Celgene, in the beginning of 2000, I was on the IPO for a company called Signal Pharmaceuticals. We filed the IPO. 85 companies went public in the year 2000. Right after the IPO was filed, boom, they had a toxicity in phase one. The compound was dead. What do? Well, we decided to sell the company. That was a horrible concept. That was viewed as death, capitulation, white flag. How could you ever do that? But we decided, you know what, we'll sell the company. So we ran a process, and I hate to say it, but there was only one bidder. I didn't tell, of course, Sal and John that, but there was one bidder at the time, and it was Celgene. And why did Celgene want to buy this company? Because they had 30 to 40 very good medicinal chemists. It was called Signal Pharmaceuticals because they were experts in signal transduction. And Saul Barra, John Jackson, and Bob Eugen all felt that Celgene was doing well with Thalamid, but it needed to backfill. It needed to have some research strength, some wet labs, and they really wanted that research intellectual discipline to fuse to the Thalamid molecule. And they ended up buying it, and the stock went up. But I just wanted to mention that it's very rare that you see a company, you know, that's very close to commercialization actually go out and buy a discovery engine. And I can say this now because I've heard John Jackson say this, but Signal and those scientists helped Celgene in many ways, and one of them was to deconvolute all the IMiDs. But just an example of culture that everybody passed on Signal because they said, oh, they have a failed molecule. There's nothing there. But to the credit of Celgene's management, they had the guts to go out and do it. And, in fact, the retention rate, I can ask you this, I think the retention rate was phenomenal in terms of the Signal employees. They lost one person after 3 years, and he became a priest. So John Jackson said, we could not compete with God. Anyway, I don't know if my facts are totally correct, but that's an approximation. I want to go to Lewis maybe to get your perspective on the quest for cure and, you know, how have you seen the leverage?
Yes.
And maybe you can just give one or two specific examples of how LLS has really provided a major acceleration of a therapy. Because that's the goal here,
sure.
To accelerate therapies.
Sure, be happy to do that. So let me take you back to 2010. We actually partnered with Ed Saltzman, Jeff Bachman, and Mike Rice of Defined Health to do something that hadn't been done before, and that is have a not-for-profit, a voluntary health agency, create a research agenda of its own. And the folks at Defined Health worked with us to evaluate 12 indications in the hematological malignancies. They did the kind of work for us that they might have done for a Celgene or for another company, evaluating the landscape of the patient experience, the treatment, and the science. We didn't have them do a commercial landscape because, frankly, we weren't interested in the commercial side. But the point of that work was to have us understand better where the key strategic places for investment might be to accelerate the rate at which new treatments could come to the blood cancers. We used that work, that foundational work, to then approach our scientific advisory board, get them to help us refine what the Defined Health folks had, the work product that the Defined Health folks had created, and establish for LLS a research agenda. When we met with Tom and the folks at Celgene, we presented that work to them and jointly agreed upon portions of it where we could uniquely see an opportunity through funding in the academic setting to advance some fundamental pieces of science that were strategic and that were, frankly, going unfunded. So that's a little bit of the background of how we got to the Quest for Cures program and why I think it's been impactful. In terms of accelerating programs, the therapy acceleration program, as we call it, was really born out of the realization that we are funding 300 projects in academic science right now. Every year, we're funding 300 active projects, and that every year, a significant fraction of them, 10% or so, move out of what we would call discovery into what we would call development. They're going in the direction of therapies for patients, the direction that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society want them to go into. But especially back when we created the program in 2007 and 2008, there wasn't any funding available for those investigators to take those programs through development. And so we created the program to harvest out of our own grant portfolio those projects that had moved into development, bring development resources to them, bring development expertise, and advance them more rapidly to the goal line. And we've had a couple of examples in being successful at doing that. We'll have one announced in the next week or so in partnership with the University of Michigan. Research funded as a grant around mixed lineage leukemia and the development of a potential small molecule to treat those leukemias. Interesting work was done with the grant funding. We took it under the auspices of the Therapy Acceleration Program. We brought medicinal chemistry support to that team, have evolved a number of compounds. towns, and what we'll announce next year is the partnership of that program with a small biotechnology company to take that forward. So there's a specific example of having accelerated something out of the academic environment and now into the hands of drug developers. We've done something similar with our partnerships with small biotechnology companies. There we're looking to we have a bit of a different model than the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. Rather than going all in with one company, we have partnered with many. And we're looking to use our dollars to help those companies get over a particular development hurdle so that they can have the data required to go back to the capital markets or get a big pharmaceutical company partner and continue to pursue the programs. And what I can tell you in terms of a marker of success there, last year, five of the small companies that we had partnered with saw a third-party deal flow from Big Pharma. An outright acquisition, licensing deals, and the like. So we consider that having done the job that we set out to do, gotten those companies over that development hurdle and made them attractive to the pharmaceutical industry.
Great. Louise, you know, when MRA was founded, the phrase immuno-oncology didn't exist, or it was IL-2. I don't want to say it was a backwater, you know, 10 years ago, but there was alpha interferon, there was DTIC, and IL-2. It was very limited, and now there's been an explosion. Maybe you can just talk about how, you know, you guys have played a role in this, you know, fantastic acceleration of new therapies.
I mean, there's really no doubt, and you heard it over the course of the presentations over the last 2 days, that melanoma is indeed the case study for the use of immuno-oncology agents, and I would argue that it's not only the case study there, but also for using precision medicine approaches. Melanoma has tailored therapy for BRAF mutant patients where there are two specific mutations that there are drugs that have been developed and approved for. We've, as an organization, we funded research in support of understanding how to use these drugs and to use them better to overcome resistance for every one of the approved therapies, ranging from the targeted therapies through the immuno-oncology agents. I want to just kind of point to a couple of key things because it's just so telling from the conversation that has taken place here in New York. We've talked extensively about biomarkers, and a lot of the conversation has turned to PD-L1 as a biomarker. We funded the research that first described by Suzanne Topalian, my predecessor, our former CSO, that PD-L1 was a potential biomarker, but that it is not the be-all, end-all biomarker for all of the reasons that we've talked about. It's dynamically regulated and so on. And ipilimumab, approved in 2011, really set the stage for the immuno-oncology market and the way we view things today. It has shown that there are about 1 in 5 patients who will experience 10 years long-term survival. And for a disease like metastatic melanoma, which was virtually a death sentence, that is amazing progress. We all anticipate that with improvements in our understanding of how to use these drugs, that things will go better and better as drugs are used in combination. One of the programs that we've funded most recently is another joint funding program with Stand Up to Cancer to extend the immunology dream team that's supported by Stand Up to encompass melanoma. Melanoma was not included in the original design of that immunology dream team's work. And the studies that are being proposed there are exactly ones that are scientifically constructed to address the questions of who responds and who fails to respond to IPI, Nevo, or the combination of the two. And this is the kind of signal-seeking study that needs to be done, and I'm actually very pleased to be part of that. We looked recently at the 145 projects that we've funded since our inception, not in a year. Like, I always wonder why I get seated next to Lou, but it's a significant number of programs. And when you look at those programs, you're very proud of the research that you funded. But I just want to point to one other thing that has really impacted patients, and there's really no good way to capture this. At the ASCO meeting 2 years ago, the first data on the phenomenal responses to the anti-PD-1 antibodies was disclosed. We visited with the folks at the FDA at their place in Silver Spring because we had heard at a meeting, at an Alexandria Summit meeting actually, that the FDA wasn't able to travel to ASCO that year because money was too tight. So we basically brought the science to them and talked to them about it. And the conversation turned to how disappointing it was for them. And I have this vision of a patient in my mind at the ASCO meeting who heard these great results and yet knew that from the time that those results were disclosed to patient availability was going to be potentially years, even with accelerated approval in mind. And so we went, we basically undertook shuttle diplomacy with both BMS and Merck to encourage them to undertake expanded access programs, compassionate use programs in a constructive, organized way to provide melanoma patients with the opportunity to access these drugs. And I saw recently, Merck was the first to open. BMS subsequently opened. Both of those were single-agent anti-PD-1 EAPs, and BMS subsequently opened the combination EAP with Ipi and Nivo. So three EAPs in one indication with essentially the same drug is just unheard of. And I recently saw that Merck has announced that their expanded access program enrolled 3,500 people. Now, when that drug was approved, that's worldwide, by the way, when that drug was approved, that meant that some substantial fraction of those in the U.S. were paying customers for Merck. And so not only did we help people, but it was a win-win with the company. And I am very proud that we helped some of those people, and I'm proud that we helped our colleagues in the companies as well.
Thank you. You know, when you think about the disease advocacy groups, and Lewis, you hit the nail on the head, which is you're the honest broker. You guys have the cred. You guys have the singular focus, the major objective. However, when I spoke to Mrs. Hamburg 2 years ago, that was before the CF Foundation and the $3.3 billion royalty recapture from the Aurora deal, a legacy of the Aurora Vertex M&A deal. When you look at that deal and you look at, again, does that kind of muddy the waters a little bit that here a foundation that was perceived to be above it all, had a great track record, came in there and got major leverage for its money, got some royalties, but now made $3.3 billion. Does that change a little bit of the ecosystem in terms of the objectivity and being the honest broker?
So, Mark, we don't see it that way.
Okay.
I put up that slide. We've invested $1 billion. My organization is a fiduciary for a million blood cancer patients in the United States. And I talk with a lot of them, and what they want are cures as quickly as possible now. And so I think that those dollars, I think the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation made a major investment of not only dollars but expertise in the creation of that therapy. I truly believe that it would not exist if they weren't behind it, and I think they deserve the return they got, and they will invest it to find additional cures. I think it's we don't see it as muddying the waters at all.
If I can just chime in, this is something that universities deal with all the time. We're not doing enough with our research. When we get a product on the market and we get royalties, we're doing too much with our research. You can find those articles in the same edition of the Wall Street Journal. It's distressing to us. I think there's a lot of cystic fibrosis patients out there that are not helped by Kalydeco. And the fact that the CF Foundation now has this endowment that they can use and go out and help the rest of those CF patients, I think is a fabulous thing and something we should all celebrate. Does anyone really think that the price of that drug would be less if the CF Foundation didn't get a return?
Louise, your view from the MRA perspective?
I think it's, at its face, I've done venture philanthropy both at MRA and my previous life at the MMRF, where we did actually invest in companies, and we negotiated a return on investment from those companies for when wonderful things happen. It was capped; it wasn't totally dilutive. I think it's completely nonsensical to me that we should be viewed as we nonprofits should be viewed as free money to support industry objectives. I think we're part of the investors in the problem, in solving the problems, and we should, you know, get some reasonable share of that back to reinvest in our continued missions. And most of us would like to be out of work doing something different eventually. So I think I think it's a bit of smoke, actually.
It's in the press, but Tom, you're.
You know, I'm going to go back to Lou's former title as mission officer. You know, the impact of medicines that we create, and we don't discover them, we create them, right? The impact is, in many cases, in my view, underplayed by patient advocacy groups, patients, and in the public eye. And we have to recall that once drugs go off patent, they are available for patients in perpetuity at a generic or reduced rate. And somehow, in the formula of value creation, we've lost perspective on how impactful. For example, myeloma, you know, was a death sentence in 2 years average a decade ago. Now, I'm quite sure it's over 10 years. I mean, JP may want to comment, but it will exceed 10 years. And those drugs have, you know, literally created immense value. A number of them will come off patent over a short period of time. So I think, in a way, we have to challenge and redirect the conversation. And it's particularly important, in my view, right now as federal funding for research is compromised, academic organizations are struggling. I'm very pleased that the capital markets have opened up and that we're able to find, you know, public dollars coming back to innovation and to changing the landscape for patients. But all of us in this room owe it to patients to get this redirect on the conversation right. And so I'm really glad you asked the question, Mark, and I think it's worthy of maybe a topic at the next meeting. You know?
Okay. Can I add on something as well? I think at Lilly, one of the ways that we've worked with LLS and some others as far as foundation, and you heard it earlier in the talks, is, you know, allowing the institutions, the academicians, and the folks who are on the ground treating patients on a daily basis be able to help dictate how some of that research goes. And I think that that's one of the benefits that the foundations brings forward is really that direct connection with the investigators and the academic institutions directly. And what the way that we've approached that in helping to redirect that conversation is how do we take what might be funds that are in our limited partner funds or other funds, and how do we direct those toward either research that the foundations see are interesting, or that the academic investigators that they're, you know, collaborating with see as interesting? How do we get those two connected? And so at Lilly, that's one of the efforts we've done a lot of is really to try to research the external environment and bring those two pieces together, the funding as well as the new innovative idea that even, you know, together with the foundation, what we appreciate are the opportunity to have direct access to the academicians who can do the clinical research, right, which hasn't been forgotten, right? It's the opportunity to really bring those together and tackle the real problems, the real, experiments within the clinic that not all of us are there doing on a daily basis.
You know, each of the panelists touches New York and New York City in some way. And Kathleen, as you said, this was the most siloized place. Nobody would talk to anybody. And one of the great disasters of the New York ecosystem is that at 68th Street in York and First Avenue, GCSF was discovered. And this Manhattan Island watched that molecule go out to Thousand Oaks. Think about how many thousands of jobs, and think about how many other companies would have been spun off if it were licensed to a New York company or somebody in this, you know, New York tri-state area. But maybe, Kathleen, you could spend just a couple of minutes quickly on how much it has changed. And, in fact, Mark Tessier-Levine at Rockefeller has really been the guiding light here on really literally changing the entire foundation of how New York is interacting with life sciences.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Dr. Tessier-Levine certainly has been active. Some credit goes to his colleagues, of course, Craig Thompson at Memorial Sloan Kettering, Lori Glimcher at Weill Cornell, and all the other leadership of the academic medical centers who've been very good at collaborating. New York's a tough issue. The number of dollars for funding that comes here from various sources amongst the 13 major academic institutions, research institutions, is enormous. And I guess we're second in the country. I think that's NIH dollars. We're probably even closer when you take all funding put together. It's the output that comes out of here is enormous. The royalties that come into Rockefeller and my fellow institutions are $500 million a year. Well, you can say, well, that's disgusting. No, it's not. It represents products that are being sold out there that are actually helping people. And that's the way we like to look at it. That far exceeds any collection of royalties in San Francisco, any collection of royalties in San Diego, any collection of royalties among the Boston universities by about threefold on an annual basis. So that means three times more of our products are being sold out there, mostly in the life sciences, a lot of them in cancer. And we just have not been known for starting companies. And that's where those other three places that I mentioned get their buzz from. And we all know, I mean, go outside. You know the problem in New York. It's expensive. It's difficult to get from point A to point B. The thought of having animal facilities here has to be daunting. The thought of getting rid of your radioactive waste, the thought of getting permits. Things are changing. The government, Bloomberg administration was fabulous. It made a lot of changes, made everyone's life a little easier. Now we have the accelerator, the New York City Venture Fund. We hope to keep more companies. It's not that we don't start companies. They just go somewhere else. And we hope to keep them here. That would make us all really happy. It would make our faculty ecstatic. They do not like getting on trains and buses and planes. If they could just get on the subway and go and visit their company for the afternoon, that would be a great thing. And we're seeing that day coming. We are looking at incubator facilities. There's an incubator up in Harlem now, Harlem Biospace, which is a very innovative, very for early stage companies. We're looking at a branch of that at Rockefeller. We're looking at a branch of a higher end incubator at Rockefeller or something for the Upper East Side. I know, an incubator on the Upper East Side. Who'd have thought? One of the big changes that's happened is that there's a lot of human resources available in New York. There's a lot of young people who want to live in New York, which was not the case at least 30 years ago. And now pretty much everyone who graduates from college, not everyone, but many people who graduate from college want to spend some time here. So we should be able to take advantage of those human resources and really get a more diversified industry here, life sciences industry.
Thank you. So, Tom, I want to come back to Celgene for a moment. You know, you look at the fact that it really, I think, is the paragon of that fluid, external, you know, the new research paradigm. It never had that central headquarters culture of top-down, that giant campus, you know, where all research was funneled to, you know, one group or one person. New Jersey water is sometimes, you know, has some toxic elements in it. But what's in the water at Summit? What's, if you drill down for a minute for the companies in the audience that want to mimic or want to really understand what's contributed to your ability to cut all these creative deals from Epizyme to Agios to Patrick Soon-Shiong's company, et cetera. What's been the driving force that's allowed Celgene, as it grows, to maintain the innovation? Usually as you get bigger, you lose the innovation. Looks like as you guys have gotten bigger, you're actually improving on it.
I really am pleased it appears that way. It is a fight every day. But I would also tell you that Bob Hugin, our CEO, who was part of that triumvirate that you mentioned, our board, and probably most dominantly the history of the company, JP has heard me say before, you know, we have a contrarian culture. So in a sense, it's been very easy to do alternative things, particularly when they were grounded in science and in the notion that they could potentially be transformational. So I think those are effectively the cultural elements that are, I guess, anchoring, you know, pillars for. But I would also say that, you know, that is always under threat. I think one of the deep considerations for our research organizations distributing itself and having multiple sites has been the concern that you get beyond a certain size and you start to reduce to the mean the exceptional performance of a small group. And so even through some of the acquisitions we've done, including a company that LLS contributed to, Avila Therapeutics, we have endeavored to keep that site, those people, and that specific culture in place and sort of thriving. But I will tell you, it is difficult. But in my view, it's worth the difficulty.
Great. Any questions from the audience? Let's open it up. Anybody? Louise, maybe you can talk just a little bit about how did you guys get so involved with immuno-oncology? You know, how did you find Jim Allison? And how did the checkpoint revolution, which could have, I believe now if you count the PD-1 antibodies, they've shown activity in 24 tumors, but yet the first two, melanoma was the first indication, which says something.
I think the introduction really started at a point in time that we were coming together. It's a simple idea, as you sort of articulated it early, that folks with means and a specific interest in a disease decide that they're going to change the course of that disease and found a nonprofit. But the reality is it's not that simple to actually start and implement a good mechanism to decide where to spend your money and how to spend your money. One of the things MRA did at its inception was to have a call to action meeting, bringing together the best of the best in the field to discuss what are the challenges and what are the opportunities. And crystallizing out of that meeting really was that immunotherapy, immuno-oncology with checkpoint blockade, as it has evolved, is really something that we ought to be paying very close attention to. I think for those of you who have been in the pharmaceutical industry for many years, you will know that melanoma was never on anyone's list of things that you were allowed to work on because you couldn't make any money, there weren't enough patients who cared about them anyway, and it's backwater and everything goes there to die in clinical development. And so you can well imagine that included a lot of immunotherapy approaches too. The melanoma community is quite a tight-knit community, and so to have the catalyst of MRA be able to bring the great lights together like Jim Allison along with the other KOLs in the field to focus on what are the most important questions, how can we invest research dollars wisely to answer those questions and keep a sustainable, transparent research enterprise going. That's really the initial recipe for putting together an organization that has been successful as MRA has. It starts to sound easy, but it's actually pretty difficult to do, as Lou well knows.
Yeah, I can add one thing, which is a lot of Jim Allison's research was funded by disease philanthropy. And in fact, Medarex got outside funding, and there was a huge fear that Jim Allison could kill people and unleash, you know, a massive autoimmune reaction. So there was a lot of skepticism, but it actually took a disease advocacy foundation. The same is true for Velcade. I can tell you on Velcade, I believe 57 companies passed on it because they said there's no way there's any selectivity in the target. And yet it was Chris Logothetis and MD Anderson who raised his hand and said, you know what, let's take it into the clinic. He got some funding from a foundation, and the rest is history. Louis, you have something to add?
I'd just say I'd echo what both you and Louise just said. I think what it exemplifies here is the risk profile of a foundation. So we're willing to accept a different kind of risk. Since the topic of immunotherapy is on the table, I can tell you that we began funding the group at the University of Pennsylvania that developed the CAR T therapy approach in 1998, and we continued to fund them from 1998 until, and actually we continue to fund them now, even during times when, frankly, that approach fell out of scientific favor. But for both of our organizations, when an application comes to our peer review panel, everyone around the table is a specialist in the blood cancers. And so we have we bring a different kind of insight into where progress can be made in a strategic way. So I think what you're seeing here really is the demonstration of that different kind of risk profile and a willingness to put dollars at risk.
Yeah, I think that laser beam approach really does work. In fact, if you look at Celgene, Novo Nordisk, and Gilead, and you look at the fact they're not in 22 disease areas, but they drill down to the bedrock in only a handful, yet they've all had very high multiples, and they've done very well. Tom, anything? Do you want to comment on that, or I assume you would agree?
I agree.
That the laser beam. Any other questions or any other? Sure.
Funding from a U.S. perspective. If you look at cancer research as internationalization of it, I think oncology more than any other therapeutic areas, with the sole exception of probably infectious disease, is where it's extremely high quality cancer research, especially research focused on new therapeutics, drug discovery, chemistry, and the quality is really improving. Maybe the panel can address in the last few minutes, where do they see opportunities or models for funding and conducting cancer research internationally in these models?
Great question, Kapil. Anybody want to take that?
I could just say that I won't comment on a specific area, but what I can say is over the history of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, we have no geographic restrictions or citizenship restrictions on where our dollars go. We're really looking for the very best science and the very best medicine anywhere in the world. Currently, somewhere between 15% and 20% of our research dollars go outside the U.S., and that includes both funding in academic institutions and funding in the private sector.
Yeah, likewise, we fund research around the world. There is a persistent trend that I've seen in my 7 years in the nonprofit business that the applications received from ex-U.S. researchers just are not up to the – they're not constructed in the same way. They're not written in the same way. They're just not up to the standards of a peer review panel that tends to be largely U.S.-centric. And it's kind of a persistent problem, but I see it shifting gradually, and I think it will probably accelerate in years to come. I think the international, especially on the international researchers, especially on the cancer clinical side, have a tremendous amount to offer. In terms of centralization, I think it's a great opportunity to work with them.
Any other questions, or we should probably wrap up? Okay, I want to thank the panelists. That was a really enjoyable discussion.
Thank you, Mark.